Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to Red Box, the politics podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. Get my daily email briefing on what's happening at politics at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. This week I'm joined by three people who've shaken off their migraines to abide by the three-line whip to be here. Michael Savage, the Times' chief political correspondent, will argue there are times when it is better off if the speaker doesn't, well, speak. Columnist Melanie Phillips asks when we should align with and sell arms to despotic regimes. But first, Phil Collins on anything but Brexit.
It is time to talk about something else. Europe is consuming all the available energy in government, and it's taking all the space in newspapers and in news bulletins. It's not only boring, it's also an error of proportion. The untold story of Europe is it doesn't matter as much as people think. The hopes of the Eurosceptics are a fantasy. The fears of the Europhiles are vastly exaggerated. It will probably be mildly good or mildly bad, and the verdict won't be entered for years anyway. So it's time to talk about housing, the NHS, and education, or social care, or something else.
Well, this is music to my ears, because every week I sort of try to make the... I consider making the podcast a Brexit-free zone, and then something else comes along, and then we end up having to talk about it. So let's talk about the other stuff that you think we should be talking about.
Oh, I want to talk about Europe. I want to talk about not talking about Europe. I will talk about the other stuff, but just a reflection on it, because it's... As a columnist, people always say to you when there's a big story around, in the moment, two big stories, Trump and Europe, oh, it must be great for you. And in fact, it's usually the opposite, because they're the only stories around. There's only limited things that any one person can say about them. So actually, it reduces the scope of things to talk about, because you feel slightly odd writing a column about education policy in a week when it's not in the news at all. And yet you think, but I want it to be in the news, so can I put it in the news? So it's actually a really peculiar time when you get the dominance of something like this.
I have exactly the same thing every morning writing the Red Box email, when I feel obliged to put Trump or Brexit at the top. But I know that if I do that, the fewer people will open it, they'll click on it, you know, that you do need a bit of variety. But those two things are dominating. But
there's also, I've got a substantive point about it too. It's not just lament for the fact that I've got nothing else to write about. It's I have always thought that the issue of Europe is less important than most other people seem to think it is. I exempt from that class of most other people the British electorate, who in every general election rank it about item number 14. It's not that important to them. Now, of course, when you ask people a direct question, they're going to have a view on it. It turns out they're mostly against it. But that doesn't mean to say that they've therefore decided it's incredibly important. And I think they're right. I think the outcome in the end of Britain being outside the European Union may be good, it may be bad, but we won't know for ages. And I suspect that it will be nowhere close to the sunlit uplands of Daniel Hannan, or nowhere close to the 3 million job losses of Nick Clegg. I suspect, boringly, the truth will be that it's a boring subject with a boring truth somewhere in the boring middle.
Melanie, did you find Europe exciting?
I have great sympathy with what Phil just said. I also wake up every morning thinking anything but Brexit or Trump. But I disagree in the sense that, I agree absolutely. We don't know what's going to happen. It may well turn out to be less than or more than or whatever. But I just think that it is the biggest thing to have happened in at least a generation. It's hard to exaggerate the importance and significance and scale of what Britain is about to do, to detach itself from Europe, with which we have been so intimately involved for all these years. The act of disengaging legally in terms of what that will entail is enormous. And consequently, I think it's only right and proper that we should be giving so much attention to it. I also think that, you know, as journalists, we're brought up to believe that if we say the same thing twice in a week, everyone goes, oh, yawn, yawn, you know, let's move on to something new. But actually, I find that people are consumed by this because they are either very concerned or they're very excited, but they are certainly agitated one way or the other. It's a subject where I don't recall a domestic subject ever having this degree of traction among ordinary people. So I chew the carpet just like Phil at being dragged back into Brexit, the Brexit sphere once again, but I find it's almost inevitable that I am.
Michael, do you think the difference between those previous elections when Europe hasn't been an issue is because it seemed like a settled issue, so people weren't agitated about it, but something is actually happening now in a way that it wasn't before?
Well, it's not only happening, it's consuming sort of Whitehall completely, really. And one of the issues is that the Whitehall machine sees it as such a big task, because everything is touched by this question of EU membership, that it's in overdrive, doesn't have enough people, it's panicking, it's all it's doing, it's sucking all the energy. But one person who will be delighted by this item is the Prime Minister, who is very keen that her...
Who does listen.
We know,
sure.
She's a regular listener, and we might even get a letter after the podcast. But
Do leave a review on iTunes, Prime Minister, that would be much more useful.
I think that's her usual practice. But she is desperate to have other things apart from Brexit to define her premiership. So she's talked about social justice, the unfairness, trying to improve meritocracy. That also brings problems. So the moment you introduce new policies and programmes that haven't been in a manifesto through a general election, you don't necessarily have the same mandate. So you run into problems of the Lords blocking it, and it's really difficult.
But so she has to try, because a government which is defined by a single issue is always running the risk, for the obvious risk, that if that single thing goes awry, you've got nothing else. Now, maybe it's all going to be fine, but perhaps it won't be. Perhaps in 2 years' time, with a downturn in the economy, not necessarily attributable to us leaving the EU, but there will probably be one, it might look quite choppy. And if at that time we're going through negotiations which are difficult, the government will need other things to be able to say, well, yes, we know we're doing this monumental thing, but also, in addition, we do this. We're about that. We're fixing the NHS. We've got an education plan. So I think it's very important for the government as well to have other things to do, not to mention the country. Because, I mean, there are big things going on. Other things carry on. Life carries on even while we're consumed with this.
Yeah, you know, I've been struck by when I've met figures, particularly on the right of the Conservative Party, Conservative MPs, by how much Brexit has overtaken sort of their worldview. So people who previously I had talked about education, or particularly the deficit, people who were really hawkish on the deficit, that whole argument has just totally been swamped by Brexit. And actually, most of them are completely happy to see a splurge in spending if it's going to straighten out Brexit in the longer term. So even for those MPs, it's really dominated.
And if that was bad before, if that is a bad thing, well, it'll be bad now. And yet we just, our tensions disappeared.
I agree it's important that the government should have be developing other policies. But I think that even if it had a tremendous success in housing and the NHS and education and social policy, and everybody thought, you know, it's a really whiz-bang domestic programme, if Brexit goes pear-shaped, that is what Mrs. May will be brought down by, and that is how she will be judged in immediate terms and in history, I'm afraid.
This is what David Cameron has left her with. It's an awful thing to have to define yourself as, and it's, as Melanie says, it's unavoidable. It will define her for good or ill. And my thesis is that it's actually not going to be, in the consequences of it, in the end, will be hard to decipher, because what we'll have now is this constant war of attribution. Every single thing that happens, people will fight again the original battle about whether we should be in or out with respect to that piece of economic data. So the economy will turn down. One side will say, this is because we're at the European Union. The other side will say, no, it isn't. And we'll have this constant battle. But the actual attributable consequences of this decision will take place over very many years, will be hard to measure, and we won't really ever come to a settled verdict.
By the time you could make any serious judgment about whether or not it was a good idea, we'll have forgotten how we got into that mess in the first place, because it takes such
a long
time.
So politically, it will never quite happen as a cataclysm in the way that the 2007 crash did, for example.
And there are lots of reasons why parallels are drawn between Theresa May and Gordon Brown, but in the way that his premiership became defined by the crash, and then when we got to the end of the sort of emergency period of that, it turned out there wasn't anything going on in Gordon Brown's government, and there is a risk for Theresa May that the same thing happens. And actually worse than that, because as you said in your list, Phil, you know, housing is a big issue, the NHS crisis is a massive problem, social care funding, education, and there are bits happening on there, but there's always the risk that when the Prime Minister tries to do something on it, it looks a bit token, and everyone says, what are you bothering with that for? Brexit's the big thing. And then they just do Brexit, and everyone says, why aren't you doing stuff for all the other areas?
It's difficult. I mean, as Michael said, the capacity of the state, of the machine, is eaten up with this extraordinary complex thing. Every department has to engage in it. So it's not easy for them to do anything else. But other things will carry on happening even if they don't do anything.
I'll just make one small sort of revisionist point on the comparisons between Gordon Brown and Theresa May. Gordon Brown wanted the top job for years and years and years, and yet when he arrived in Downing Street, amazingly, he didn't seem to have a fully formed leadership plan, programme of what he wanted to do. The crash came along, it's something he was good at, he got involved. With Theresa May, from the very outset, Brexit and the whole question around Brexit has been thrust upon her. So she's known from the outset, this is what she's going to do. All the other things she'll try and do as well, but she's known from day one, it's about Brexit.
Just before we move on, just from the three of you, if you were talking to the Prime Minister and you said, well, if there's one thing she should concentrate on apart from Brexit, what should she be doing, Melanie?
I think she should be taking the bull by the horns and, to mix my metaphors dreadfully, slaughtering the sacred cow of the NHS, moving to a continental style of social insurance, because this cannot go on, this appalling mess of the NHS, pouring more and more money in, short-term sticking plaster remedy. The fundamental fact, it seemed to me for very many years, is that the NHS model is bust. Nobody will admit it for all the obvious reasons. It's a sacred cow. It defines Britain. But it's a model that doesn't work, cannot work now, will not work in the future. And people who can't afford to extricate themselves through private insurance are really, really suffering. And I just don't think it's right. And I think that, you know, a visionary prime minister would actually say, right, you know, we've just got to face this now and we've got to do something different.
She'd certainly get Europe off the front pages if she went for the abolition of the NHS. So that's the job done.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure the Prime Minister would take your... Yeah, as well as doing Brexit, you need to carve up the NHS. Michael, what would be your advice?
Bold minister. Housing. Prime Ministers always talk about the need for more housing and to build more homes. There's now a huge problem with young people being able to buy. It's actually a distant dream already for many people. Get on and build more homes.
And we're seeing this week the housing white paper, but interestingly, that's been fronted up by Sajid Javid. It's not something the Prime Minister is taking hold of in the same way that she did earlier in the year with mental health and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's so many institutional opponents to house building because you get into issues around NIMBYism and the Green Belt and all the rest of it, but it's just something that someone at some point is going to have to do.
And Phil, you've been in the room talking to the Prime Minister when you worked for Tony Blair. Would you?
Well, one of the things that that government never made any progress on, and which the coalition government didn't make any progress on, was the education of about half the country who don't pursue an academic path. And in Theresa May's first speech when she became Prime Minister was a fairly boilerplate meritocratic speech, but all good stuff. And if she wants to make good on that, then she do something about the education curriculum for those kids, and there's lots of them, who are failed after the age of 14 because we force them down an academic path which is not suitable for them.
loads of food for thought there. There's probably a whole another podcast on that. Let's move on though for now, and Melanie, let's look at foreign affairs.
This week, the High Court starts hearing the claim that arms sales to Saudi Arabia breach weapons export laws. This is because of claims that the British armed Saudi-led coalition in Yemen is disproportionately killing civilians. In fact, there's evidence that the Houthi rebels are using civilians as human shields. The deeper issue is whether it's ever right to ally ourselves with despotic regimes.
Melanie, you've written about this in your column this week. As I was reading it, I was thinking, well, is this a case of my enemy's enemy may be my friend? But then as you point out, it could be my enemy's enemy may still be my enemy. There again, my enemy's enemy may be my enemy, but also my friend at the same time. And this is the problem.
Precisely.
In politics generally, but in foreign policy as well, people like to pick goodies and baddies, and actually it's more complicated than that.
It's very complicated, and particularly in the Middle East, where it's incredibly complex and confusing, not least because people who are enemies in the Middle East may be simultaneously allies in another cause. So you have, for example, Sunni and Shia at each other's throats historically, and yet they come together when it comes to opposing or fighting Western interests. That's just one example. But I find this, I mean, it's a really horrendous problem, and I think about it a lot. When I'm trying to avoid writing about Brexit or Trump, I write about it because it's a really thorny issue. You know, you have these dreadful regimes which are, you know, tyrannical over their own people, which may be posing a threat to us. I mean, Saudi Arabia is the foundational state where the Wahhabi strain of Islam, which led to Islamic extremism and Islamic terrorism, which so threatens us and is you know, has taken so many lives in the West. That's where it started, and Saudi has exported that and continues to export that through funding institutions of further education and learning in Britain and America and in other countries. So, you know, for years, Saudi has been not just an enemy of the West, but has actually been subverting and undermining us. And yet, there are other causes where we need Saudi Arabia's help, for example, in fighting Iran. And so it's in Sunni Saudi Arabia's interest to fight Iran wherever it can. That shouldn't really concern us, except that it does concern us because Iran, in my view, poses an immediate and unconscionable threat to the West. And yet we've all behaved over the years as if this war that Iran has been prosecuting against us hasn't been happening. And anyone who's talked about taking action against Iran because of this is vilified as a warmonger. Now, Saudi Arabia can't have that. And it's in our interests to help stop the march of Iran in the region. That's why Philip Hammond, when he was Foreign Secretary, said, we will give Saudi Arabia every help that we can, short of military involvement, short of our combat troops on the ground. However, there is a question of whether that Saudi-led coalition is disproportionately killing civilians. And if it is, then that's something that we should be concerned about, and I think we should be bending every sinew to persuade the Saudis to do this stuff properly, to prosecute the war in Yemen according to the Geneva Conventions. Now, our government says it is. Saudi says it is investigating claims of abuses. We don't know whether to take that really seriously. But there is evidence, as I said in my column, that you know, civilian casualties are dreadful, whoever causes them. But the fact is that there are numerous reports that the Houthis are using civilians in Yemen as human shields. That is to say, they are positioning their men and materials among civilian population, either to deter the Saudi coalition from attacking them, or if they kill the civilians, then they can count on international outrage from the Oxfams, the Save the Children's, and so on, to stop the military action against them. And I think it poses very serious problems for any democratic state that wants to defend itself but also wants to do the right thing.
I agree. It is extremely difficult. And Saudi Arabia is the best example, as you said at the start, that it's very easy to make the case against Saudi Arabia, as you made. And yet, at the same time, we get so much from that alliance as well in other conflicts, and the demand for consistency that people always seek in foreign policy is almost impossible. To be pure and unsullied in any of these conversations is almost impossible. consistency, said La Rochefoucauld, is a hobgoblin of little minds. And it's impossible to do it. So any simple solution will never work, which doesn't stop almost all of the criticism about foreign policy being of that kind, because it almost all is. Why, it's always about hypocrisy and consistency, two virtually unimportant, unrelated questions. But can I ask you one thing, which is a pure and simple question, which is, why do we sell arms to anybody? Mm. Why don't we just not sell arms? Mm. There is one, and in a sense it's deliberately naive, but I once tested that out, that naive belief. I thought I'd write it. I wrote a column testing out my own naive argument and found it stood up much better than I thought it did. And the reaction I got from people who knew a lot more about it than I did was also quite good, in the sense they didn't think it was a ludicrous suggestion. So I offer it as a naive but non-ludicrous suggestion.
I have the same naive thought quite often, and I have great sympathy with that. The conventional argument in response is that if we don't sell arms, then other worse people will. And I do think actually that is quite a serious thing. But then there is the additional thing that if you have a situation like Yemen, and there are other situations, where we actually do have a dog in the fight because it's not our conflict, but on the other hand, the blowback to us would be so bad, we do need to take a side against X and in favour of Y, then if we don't want to put boots on the ground, then we really do have to arm and equip people who will do it for us. And so, you know, the alternative to that, if you're not going to sell arms to anybody, is that you stand back and you allow, you know, ISIS to operate without being stopped wherever it's operating. You allow the Houthis to win in Yemen, etc., etc., which will blow back to us and cause us to put our own people at risk. So I have sympathy, great sympathy with what you're saying, but I think it's not practical.
Michael, one of the things we've seen in recent years is the reluctance of the British public, but particularly the British Parliament, to support any military involvement. And we've seen it in Syria, we've seen it in Iraq. So is the consequence of that that we basically end up subcontracting our military involvement by either selling arms or standing behind other countries that aren't willing to step in that way?
Yeah, well, I mean, we can see what a knotty problem it is. And actually, there's a committee, quite an obscure committee in Westminster that looks at arms exports. And I remember speaking to a Foreign Office minister who said in the Foreign Office, we call it the Glorious Hindsight Committee, because obviously what it does is look backwards a couple of years after, and lo and behold, our friend is now our enemy, and suddenly all the weapons are in the hands of the wrong people. So that really tells us how complicated this problem is. And of course, when you make a decision to intervene, has consequences. And when you don't make a decision to intervene, that has consequences too. And that's often the bit that's forgotten. And of course, into this complicated debate comes the big blonde mop of Boris Johnson. And we saw exactly what happened when he said what he thought was the obvious, that Saudi Arabia acted as a puppeteer in the region. There was quite a lot of blowback from that, including from Downing Street, who, as Phil said, wanted consistency with our relationships in the Middle East.
Mm. And part of the problem is that the politicians end up sort of saying, in that, as Boris showed, nothing, because they can't get into what they basically mean, which is, well, we just have to accept that there will be some civilian casualties, or we have to accept that we're selling weapons to people that we don't necessarily like, because overall, on balance, we think that that's a price worth paying, or it's for the greater good, or we think that the alternative might be worse.
And that's why people get frustrated, voters, with foreign policy questions, because you end up saying, when you're in the Foreign Office, it's complicated. And you know what? You've got to be hard-headed about some relationships. And even though there's all these questions about Saudi Arabia and other places, do you know what? We've looked at the evidence and we've probably ended up in the right space. And that's a difficult argument to make.
But it is a fascinating argument, and I suspect it is another one of those which gets buried underneath Brexit. I'm sure we'll try and return to it in the coming weeks. Michael, let's return, let's get close to home, let's go back to Westminster and the Speaker, John Bercow.
As you say, never mind Brexit, the deficit or even the NHS crisis, nothing gets some MPs going more than a breach of parliamentary protocol. And John Bercow's excoriating attack on Donald Trump and a vow to stop him talking in Parliament has caused anger among some Tory MPs, many of whom didn't really like him in the first place. Has the Speaker done anything wrong? And could this be his downfall?
Well, it was quite extraordinary yesterday, having, you know, as I'm sure everyone does, if you tune in for points of order on BBC Parliament of an afternoon. It started off, actually, Berkeley had a big row with some Tory MPs about whether or not the clerk should be wearing a wig. He'd announced that the clerk's going to stop wearing wigs, and some of the traditionalists were very cross about this. And he was very cross with them and put them back in the box. Yeah. And actually, that would have probably been a big row on its own. And then he stood up and said he didn't think that Donald Trump should be coming. I mean, my immediate take on it is nobody's actually invited Donald Trump to speak in Westminster Hall. It's sort of been got up by MPs who don't like Donald Trump, warning that he must not be invited, to the point that they signed an EDM, or early day motion, which is like a petition for MPs, allowing Burko to stand up and knock down this enormous straw man.
Yeah, so here's the thing about John Burko. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, he annoys MPs because he can be, lo and behold, a bit pompous, a bit self-important. He spends a lot of time telling people off for talking too long before giving a huge speech himself. And on the other hand, he's been quite good for parliamentary life. He grants a lot of urgent questions. Ministers are held to account. So on the whole, he's seen probably journalistically as a good thing, but he annoys a lot of Tory MPs. And this is an occasion where he's made a big intervention on a political question, albeit an overseas political question, on Donald Trump. And he's had the effect of making his enemies in the Tory party saying, aha, you've defied your impartiality, we've got you, you're in trouble. I thought the funniest thing about the whole thing was, a few weeks ago, he told off SNP MPs for clapping because they'd just arrived, they were new, they didn't know, you weren't meant to clap, so he told them off. After he'd given his big speech about Donald Trump, he got a round of applause. And did he tell them off? No, he said to a Tory MP, sometimes it's just easier to let it go.
Rather than cause a big fuss, was what he said, which is, you know, he certainly managed to cause a big fuss. Melinda, what do you think? Do you think he overstepped the mark?
Totally. I mean, the whole point of the Speaker is that he's apolitical. That's why he's the Speaker. And it really does strike me with some force that, you know, here he is standing on his high horse saying, you know, we're not, I don't think this man, the President of the United States, should be invited to address Parliament, because basically he stands against our sort of deepest values. And there he is, the Speaker, destroying, you know, a parliamentary value, which is the impartiality of the Speaker. It's incredibly stupid. He doesn't know what the rest of Parliament thinks. Maybe the rest of Parliament, maybe the MPs all think the same thing, but it's quite possible that they don't. It's quite possible that they would think that whatever you think about President Trump, he is the leader of, he is the President of America, leader of the free world, our most important ally. And it's incredibly stupid to sort of say, you know, we're not gonna have him in. And it's just incredibly childish. I mean, racism, sexism, what, there have been no leaders who have addressed Parliament or have not been welcomed into Britain and given state banquets and, you know, tea with the Queen. I mean, all these dreadful despots that parade through Britain because it's in our interest for them to make a state visit. And, you know, this man, Donald Trump, is supposed to be worse than all these people. This is a form of hysteria, I think, that's, you know, possessing us in the West about Donald Trump. You know, I don't particularly care for him. But I mean, this idea that he is, you know, the worst witch in the world is just ridiculous. And for the Speaker to lend himself to this nonsense, it is not just nonsense, but it doesn't just demean John Burko, but it demeans the office of Speaker, and that is, I think, pretty unforgivable.
Phil?
I agree with all of that. It was grandstanding. It was very peculiar. I don't know what he thought he was doing. Insofar as I understand parliamentary protocol, he hugely overstepped the authority that he has. I don't know that is it his job even to decide this, even if there were an invitation to be forthcoming.
Well, he went to great lengths. He's one of the three key holders, which I don't know if that's literally like he's a sort of caretaker with a big bundle of keys and he'll unlock Westminster Hall if he wants to. But he was one of the three who could ultimately open the doors to Westminster Hall. I mean, the big question is that nobody's asked him to do that.
No.
There's been no conversation between Downing Street and the White House about Donald Trump addressing Westminster Hall.
But surely if he is asked at some point, it's not his job to decide that he's going to make a great big speech and say no. It's his job to get his bundle of keys and open the door, isn't it?
Well,
that's how I understood his job.
And he was quite happy. Lots of pictures have been circulated of him sort of sitting, grinning inanely behind President Xi of China. That was an okay thing for him to
for I him thought to his do. Argument, too, was nonsense. I think it is hugely exaggerated to say that President Trump is a threat to our values. I mean, what does that mean? That's a very profound statement. of whom, which is true of very few leaders in the world, and it's not true of Trump, even though he, okay, he might be a sexist. Well, yeah, loads of people are sexist in Britain. Yeah, always have been.
And actually, one thing that hasn't changed massively under Burko and the Commons is the fact that there's still a lot of sexism and misogyny. You know, only the past couple of weeks you had Nicholas Soames woofing at a female MP across the chamber. The idea that Westminster itself is this sort of
paragon. It was horrible attention seeking. I mean, there is an interesting and serious question about the extent to which Trump will respect the confines of the American Constitution. That's a very interesting question for America. John Burko seems to think he threatens the unwritten English constitution. He's the badger of our times. It was silly grandstanding.
Yeah, there's also an interesting question around the level of engagement from our government towards the Trump administration. Have they got too close too early? All those are totally legitimate questions. But it strikes me in that context where that debate is going on about how close you should be to Donald Trump, for Burko to make that intervention then felt sort of like a deliberate spike at number 10. Mm. And for a speaker to do that is really quite a big deal. I can't really think of it happening before. Now, he'll probably be saved from any sort of formal challenge by the fact that Labour and the SNP are on his side. And when you want to get rid of a speaker, basically you need a cross-party momentum to do that. But, it's very unusual.
Why do you think
unusual.
He did it, Michael? What do you think his thinking is?
Well, he... So there is this backdrop that he likes to see himself or paint himself as a sort of protector of British democracy and parliamentary tradition. There's also the backdrop that he got the job basically from the support of Labour MPs who saw him as basically a Labour person in a Tory MP's clothing. And he does also like a jab or two at his Tory colleagues, and all that adds up to this pretty big intervention yesterday.
I think you can't underestimate his enthusiasm for just winding people up, and particularly if he can wind up the government. And he's done it, you know, there were times and there were clips on YouTube of week in, week out at the unwatched departmental questions. He will have unnecessary digs at ministers and that sort of thing. And this is the sort of ultimate grandstanding dig. And because of his quite dramatic political journey from being on the right of the Tory Party to
not adhering to our basic values
exactly to now but now portraying himself as sort of halfway between the sort of Corbynista and SNP. That's his sort of, you know, and he thinks he's probably sort of overcompensating on that.
Well, if he's got an identity crisis, I wish he'd take it elsewhere to play it out rather than the Speaker's chair.
And particularly at a time when Parliament is sovereign, we're being told post Brexit, and this is where all these decisions are. You know, Parliament's playing a sort of very important role, and he should be rising above this because it's not a very big step from what he said about Trump yesterday to what he could say about the merits of Brexit and the way that's been played out and handled.
He's got one eye on his legacy, just as a Prime Minister might. How long, much longer is he going to be in the Speaker's chair? Probably not until 2020, so maybe he wants one or two things recorded.
Does that mean that if an invitation were now issued to President Trump to address the House, that he would resign? Oppose it? What can he do? Where would the formal...
Hide the keys
and not let him in? Like Black Rod, he'd be banging on the door.
Maybe he'll be overruled by the Queen. It is a state
That's
visit,
true.
After all.
Right, no. I suspect that what Donald Trump really wants isn't to address... I mean, he's not one of life's great orators. He wants the gold carriage up the Mall. He probably wants to play golf with Prince Philip. Mm. Go to Windsor. Meet Kate and William and... ruffle the heads of the royal children.
It's basically a tourist.
Exactly. He wants one of those big hats from big jester's hats from one of the stalls outside.
That's right. With John Burko with a umbrella in the air, showing him the way to go.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. Thank you very much for that. But that's all we've got time for this week. As ever, like I said, do sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. Do subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where you can leave a review, and we'll try and read out some of the best ones next week. But for now, from Phil, Michael, Melanie and me, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.